sponsored by JMR Rentals, jmrny.com.
Hello and welcome to No Rest for the Weekend. I'm Jason Godby, and today on the program, we got an industry news segment for you. We got a really special guest in the house here in the Rabbit Hole Studio. We first met her on the red carpet of the Muse Awards. She is an accomplished actor, and she's also the executive vice president for the Screen Actors Guild, Miss Linda Powell. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. Thank you so much for schlepping to Brooklyn.
Really, not that much of a schlep. It's a 2-train. I'm done. I'm here.
I appreciate it. We met during Muse Awards, and I was talking to you then about kind of, well, we were talking about Fran Drescher, who unfortunately couldn't be there to accept her award. You graciously accepted on her behalf. There's a lot that's happened since the strikes and the last time we had Joseph Melendez on the show, and he's no longer with us, unfortunately. So I'm glad you're here, and I wanted to just kind of like get a state of the union, so to speak. So, but first, before we get into all that, can you give us a little bit about your background and how you got involved with SAG?
Let's see. I got involved around 2012. It was a pre-merger, actually. It was when AFTER and SAG were negotiating a TV theatrical contract together. I think a friend of mine I'd done a play with was trying to think of New Yorkers to get on the AFTRA committee because they needed people. And I happened to be on her screen that night. I had a guest spot on something. I think it was A Good Wife. So I got a call saying, oh, I saw your show last night. That was great. Would you want to come and be part of a wages and working conditions meeting? And I had no idea what that was. So I was like, well, what do I have to do? They said, you just have to come. You have to listen to the things that are important to members. And then we talk about it later and put things in order and priority. I said, okay. It's about a 2-week-long process. At the end of it, they said, hey, do you want to go to L.A. for the plenary? And I said, what's a plenary? Because I knew nothing. I mean, I had spent those 2 weeks in complete awe of this group of, you know, actors like me who were actually doing the work that made sure I got paid. And it was something that, you know, just I had never thought about how it happened or who was in charge of it. So I was kind of fascinated. And so when they said I'd get a free trip to L.A., I was like, okay, did that. Then a couple weeks later, it's like, do you want to be part of the negotiating committee? And I said, well, why me? I don't know anything. And I think mainly it was that I showed up. And I think in the beginning, you see who shows back up. So I showed up for that. And then eventually a couple friends asked me to run for the board. So I said yes. And I've this last negotiation was either my fourth or my fifth. I've lost complete track. But I was one of the first of the became a board member the very first SAG-AFTRA board.
Oh, wow.
Like, I am the inaugural SAG-AFTRA national board. So that's been about 12 years now that I've been doing this.
It was a pretty lengthy strike. It went on for 4 months, about. So can you just give us a little bit of, like a little Reader's Digest condensed version of, like, some bullet points of what the contract stated, or like give us some highlights of provisions that it had in there?
It was a huge event for us, and I'm really proud of the things we achieved. We were able to get outsize increases in wages after a decade of being told we won't break a pattern, meaning we won't give one union more than we've given another union. We were able to break the pattern of what they gave to the DGA and the WGA. So now nobody going into negotiations has to assume that the pattern is sacred. We achieved about 14 pages of AI protections, and that's language that never existed in the contract before. That now is the beginning of protecting our members against this new technology. We got outsized increases to our pension health plans, which were much needed, and we made some got some promises on paper about diversity and inclusion in terms of stunt performers, in terms of qualified hair and makeup professionals on set, which has been an issue. We managed to combine some terms in our background contract that have kept us from being able to move New York and LA together in terms of the way that we are able to negotiate for them. A lot of things that have been on the table for a long time, because of the leverage of the strike, we were able, in addition to getting the big pieces that we were trying to move, we were able to pull a lot of other things into that. Oh, and also a brand new stream of revenue. In addition to increasing our residual stream through the terms that were already in the contract, we have a whole new stream for that's kind of a success-based metric. So big deals, big pushes.
Like some of the companies that you've dealt with, companies like Netflix, for instance, they're not public companies. They don't usually give public numbers. So, and they're always saying that the last thing they did was the greatest thing that they did. But, you know, for a while, that wasn't reflected in what they were paying people.
This
I
is
don't
an
know how
attempt
much
you... to fix that.
Right.
And we're going to, we're, you know, our members are always like, you know, well, how are we going to enforce it? What if it doesn't work? We have to put the language in and then we have to work on figuring out how we enforce this, figuring out if this formula that we came up with is really going to be a formula that works. And then we get to go back in the room again. In this time, it's like 2.5 years. Usually it's 3 years, but we struck for 6 months of that. So everything we do, we eventually have to go back and say, is this working? How do we fix it? Or yes, this is working, and maybe we can push it a little bit further. But we've got some transparency into those numbers now that we didn't have before. So we'll see. We take them with a grain of salt at all times.
It's also good to know that it's not a one and done. You know, it seems like a very organic, evolving process kind of thing.
Yeah, and there was a huge conversation amongst membership when we were had this contract out for ratification about, you know, all the AI provisions, because rightly so, this is a point of real concern for our members because it's our likeness, it's our image, and it's a technology. We're not sure how it's going to be used. So a lot of people were like, we can't do anything. We shouldn't allow anything, which didn't seem the smartest way to actually try and put guardrails around this. Seemed more wiser decision in this moment. But, you know, we also, every time we go back to the table, we now have those provisions as a starting point. And so each contract we've done since then, actually, we've built on it. The animation contract has a few stricter protections than we got in TV theatrical, because the voice only is an even more point of danger than the TV theatrical.
And some people have, like, I think James Earl Jones, for instance. James Earl Jones is going to be Darth Vader until after he's gone.
Yep. And his family will profit off of that as long as they use that.
WGA strike was 148 days. You guys, about 4 months. And then now there's been a lot of shakeup in Hollywood. We talked a little bit about this on the red carpet. There was an article in Deadline, an executive citing. It was a perfect storm of COVID and then the strikes. There has been like a 20% cut at the executive level. So a lot of people packing up their desks at studios. I don't think it's just the strikes, but I know that people being out of work for 4 months is probably not a great thing. Mm. But there's also a lot else going on right now.
So much.
So can you just kind of talk about like where we are in terms of the recovery?
Well, there's so many pieces to what you just laid out. First of all, yeah, they're cutting executives, they're cutting their workforce, but their profits are still up and their CEO salaries are going up. I forget what I read yesterday that Zaslav has now.
I think it was a ridiculous amount.
So let's not kid ourselves. They've got money. They've got money. I think COVID changed a lot of industries and changed a lot of people's priorities. I think COVID, in a way, the strikes, I think the industry was heading towards these strikes already because of the way that streaming had changed the way that the industry works, changed the way that the schedule of how they produce their content, the way that residuals worked, the way that writers' rooms were working. I think the switch from network to cable down to, let's everybody throw all of our pennies into the streaming bucket. That explosion of streaming and everybody doubling down on streaming and creating tons of content to fill the streaming beast and trying to limit their expenses while they were doing that much content, coupled with COVID, which caused everything to stop and caused everybody to re-examine what they wanted from their lives, coupled with the industry finally starting to realize, I think, the beginning of last year, maybe a little bit earlier, this isn't working. This model of production isn't working. We can't figure out how to make a profit. And then all the strikes hit.
Right.
So I think some people want to blame the strikes for there's a reduction in content that's going on. There's definitely a contraction that's going on. I think this contraction was going to be happening regardless of the strikes because they realized that they didn't have a business model that they could make profitable, and they're still trying to figure out what that is going to be in the future. I think we're starting to see a possibility of streaming with advertising that starts to look like cable TV, but on your computer instead, or on your smart TV instead.
I mean, you've got outlets like YouTube now, mm-hmm. and YouTube is basically becoming the new television. And, you know, it's unfortunate because nobody wanted that. Everybody, like the outlets like a YouTube, or they were kind of like for the people, you know what I mean? Like they were like the people's voice, and now they're just commercial television, or it feels like commercial television now.
One other thing I'd add to all of those pieces, at the generation coming up that is used to watching things on their phone, used to watching things in their pocket, used to creating their own content and sharing it with each other so they could care less about what Netflix is putting on or what CBS is putting on.
Or going to the theater.
Or going to the movies.
Yeah.
So I think everything is in flux. I think we're part of a big experiment right now. We're going to see what happens. We're going to see what comes out of it.
One of the things that I read, I saw an interview with Mark Duplass, mm-hmm. and he was actually on the red carpet of the SAG Awards, of all places. And this is February, so it's been a little while since then. But he had this quote where he said, you know, basically, it's a real effed up time. He said, I'm not going to lie. It's been very hard for people, and people are still struggling coming out of the strikes. Basically, he goes on to say that, you know, we all thought, oh, the strikes are over. We're going to get back to work.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like everybody's coming into a different industry now. You know, it's like it was one way and everybody worked that way, but, you know, we're not out of these woods. So this excitement that came out of it, but people are still kind of waiting by the phone. What's SAG's role in all this? Like how are you guys, can you even help people get back to work? And how has that been going?
I mean, honestly, there's a limit to how much we can do to get people back to work. There actually is a limit to our power to affect how the industry does and doesn't produce. What we can do is protect our members as the industry figures out how they're going to go. What we can do is try and make sure our contracts don't get in the way of things getting up and running, but not to the level that we sacrifice our well-being, our livelihood. I think another issue that's playing out right now is IATSE still has to make a deal. And
I've heard it was looking good-ish,
We'll see. I think that all the different branches have been doing well, and now the big pieces come up, and we'll see how they go. And one would hope that they learned that nobody's bluffing. But SAG-AFTRA thought that the WGA strike ending and the deal being made would lead to an easier deal for us, and that wasn't the case. So we'll see. So there could also be a holding back of production until they're sure about IATSE. Nobody quite knows which thing is causing the most contraction right now. And then there's also that things weren't put into the pipeline because the strikes were happening, and then it was Christmas, and then it was, you know, you got to get through January, and now maybe we'll start to see the things that were being held back start to go into production. It's an unknown. We're all in a very unknown time.
Well, the one thing, so, you know, we cover film festivals here, and we're gearing up right now to cover Tribeca, which is probably the biggest thing that we cover all year round. And I get stuff sent to me all the time from publicists. Biggest thing I've seen so far this year, documentaries. Tons of documentaries.
Which I love.
You know, documentaries are great. But we did a preview episode of, you know, like summer movies. And my guest, she also runs a podcast. She asked me, she's like, do you think this is a result like of what? And I said, well, you know, you got to remember there was still stuff on the books from COVID mm-hmm. that didn't get out. And, you know, we're playing strike baseball right now. You know, like we didn't get the volume of stuff that we used to get. And now, like we were saying before, like in terms of the business model, a studio making films like Avengers Endgame, you know, $300 million movie, it's got to crack over $1 billion, or your average now blockbuster budget somewhere between $1.25 to $1.50. It's got to spend at least that to market. If it doesn't crack $1 billion or at least close to, it's not considered profitable. I mean, who knew that wouldn't work out? when? And I know, and I'm not knocking studios for wanting to make money.
Right.
That's what they're supposed to.
And I think they overplayed their comic books. I think they overplayed the whole like franchise Marvel situation. You see something like Barbie and Oppenheimer that were like, you know, I mean, Barbie is kind of based on IP, but it was like a fresh, interesting, nobody expected movie.
Right.
You know, I have this vision. I want to make this movie. Let me make it. Not, we'll do another whatever.
Not every movie is a theme park.
Yeah.
You know, like not. Yeah. Not everything has to be huge. And even a movie like Oppenheimer.
Mm-hmm.
Oppenheimer wasn't some low budget indie that Nolan made, you know. he shot this movie of basically dudes talking in rooms.
Yeah.
And on IMAX. You know, like it was a huge movie.
Yeah.
Didn't use any file footage, had to have his own explosions. You know, like the other part of this equation was I remember the red carpet of Oppenheimer where the strike came down and everybody walked off. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's going to put a damper in things, because the other part of the business model, I kind of get why they did this and what, but they created this star system where you have to have these big name actors walk out on red carpets and go on Jimmy Kimmel and do these all this PR. It's like the second half of their job.
And do fashion shows. It's all tied with the fashion industry now.
Yeah, you have to be everything to all people. And, you know, and then once that was taken away, they went, oh, no, we've built this monster and now we don't know what to do, you know, because we don't have a business model that's just a movie that's about a movie. When's the last time you saw a movie make a profit that didn't really have, even like so-called indie pictures still have to have names? So those films that, you know, we grew up on like in the 90s of, you know, we don't know who these people, but it's this cool indie concept
they go straight to streaming. They don't go to the movie theater, you know? One of the conversations that we had, we were just considering the strike, just, you know, figuring out what the strike rules were going to be when we had the strike authorization, is we didn't want to damage the movie theaters. You know, nobody wants to be a part of an industry that's already struggling. You know?
Not to interrupt you, but you guys never called for a boycott.
No.
You never said, kill your Disney Plus subscription, unplug Hulu. You never said that,
no,
right?
No, I didn't. And it was, you know, there were varying opinions about whether or not we should. And I was kind of the feeling that those, especially something like, let's start with Netflix, let's do Netflix, let's do a Netflix boycott. For that to be effective, the number of people that have to cancel their Netflix subscription in order to make a dent in their business model, the foreign alone would have been, you know, it would have not have bothered them. And second of all, these industries aren't making money. These industries the corporations are making money, but the business models are not making money. It wasn't our intention to damage the things we were trying to return to.
Right, because then you're shooting yourself in the foot.
Exactly.
Saying, okay, you know, now we've crippled the industry.
We did want to put enough pressure on their bottom line that they would make a deal. And when we were talking about the strike rules and whether people would be able to promote their movies, there was some conversation about maybe we should let the summer blockbusters go. And we decided not to because
you could have struck, you know, later on.
Yeah. Or we could have said, the movies that are already in the can, you can promote, but you cannot promote anything past blah, blah, blah. Or movies that already have a release date, you can do, but not past blah, blah, blah. But it felt stronger to make a clear line in the sand. But the fact that that was even a conversation lets you know the theatrical part of the TV theatrical contract, everyone recognizes that movie theaters are struggling. You don't want to hurt the distributors while you're trying to negotiate with the producers.
Well, there was also a thing, too, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, I talked about this with Joseph when he was here, about the interim contracts.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like no business being done. It was like, if you guys agree to this set of terms, you can have a movie. And movies like Ferrari did that with Neon. And, you know, that movie had big stars in it. It had a big name director. And it did, you know, it did pretty well. It was interesting because I saw Adam Driver doing press for that when it was at New York Film Festival, because we covered it. And he was saying how, like, see, even a little studio can agree to these provisions. Why can't you big studios do it?
That's kind of the point of the interim agreements, A, to keep people working, and B, to show that the terms we were asking for weren't unreasonable. And you could not be an AMPTP producer.
Right, correct.
And sign on to an interim agreement. So we were also hopeful that, you know, to give a little boost to the independent films as well, which all of us kind of want a huge, strong, healthy, independent film industry. It's where the best stories get told. It's where, you know, people get to do things that, you know, maybe are a little out of the box for themselves. A lot of our members produce for themselves right. under independent contracts. A lot of like pie in the sky thinking when we were on breaks about maybe we could have an independent platform where we distribute our own stuff. You know, a lot of trying to figure out how we like break the model somehow.
Let me be cynical for a moment, which I'm too good at.
I just met you, but okay, go ahead.
The other side of that coin of what Adam Driver was saying, and I totally get what he's saying, but companies like Neon, they can't afford not to. Because if at that time they didn't know how long the strike was going to last, if they had said no, we're not going to break until AMPTP breaks, they wouldn't have a company, because they would have nothing to distribute. So those little distribution companies, or the smaller ones, in my opinion anyway, they look like heroes, but they were also kind of in between a rock and a hard place.
Yeah, and that worked for us. What's your point?
but it wasn't some idealistic, hey, look at these heroes of the indie film world kind of thing. At the Muse Awards, I interviewed Jennifer Esposito, and I had interviewed her previously on the red carpet of Tribeca with her film Fresh Kills, which is getting lots of acclaim, and people are saying it's wonderful. I haven't seen it yet. But, you know, she was very passionate about, hey, listen, we need different looks in authority, basically, in the higher-ups, people who choose movies, greenlight movies. But we need the audience to show up for independent film.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's like, yes, but where?
Yeah,
because
it's hard.
People aren't going to the theater to see this stuff. Like, that movie it'll do great on Netflix or, you know, wherever it lands in the streaming world. But I don't know if it's going to get big box office play, because it's not, first of all, I don't know what they spent on that film, but they probably don't have the marketing budget to compete with like Deadpool 3.
Yeah. And also think we've gotten out of the habit of going to the movie theater. We've just gotten out of the habit. And if people can watch movies like that on their couch with a great TV, with the whatever they pay for Netflix or Hulu or whatever, you know, instead of an event where you go to the theater and you spend $20 for your ticket and then you spend whatever else for popcorn and it's a night out. I just think the way that distribution of content, which I hate the word, but it's kind of, there's so much now that why do you need to leave your house? It needs to be something special to leave your house. And, you know, what I said about the phones and the kids and what they grow up watching, they don't grow up going to the movies. So I don't know. I would love to see some kind of resurgence, but I'm not sure what it looks like.
Yeah, I've had several conversations like this week, today, about AI and things like that. Now they have programs where, you know, you can type in, you know, you can do a scene between Harrison Ford and Humphrey Bogart or, you know, and things like that, which, and I've had friends telling me like, well, hey, man, you know, if you don't jump over, if you don't get with the AI train in terms of your content, you're going to be left behind. And I'm like, but is that a train I want to be on?
I think everybody's going to have to make that choice. I do think it's going that direction. We can try and stand in front of technology, but I think that's, you know, a losing battle. I mean, I read this week that the CAA has started providing as a service to some of their clients. They will scan them and create a digital replica at that the client's own, but then CAA is then in charge of licensing that digital replica out. So some people are choosing to do that. And when there are people who choose not to do that, I think the market's going to decide, people's comfort level with it is going to decide. I mean, as someone who is entrusted with helping make decisions for the union on this kind of stuff, you want to be able to protect the people who want to do it and the people who don't want to do it. You want to be able to make sure that if people are doing it, that there's consent as to what any digital version of themselves is going to be used for, and there's compensation for what any digital version of themselves is going to use for. Exactly. And we put a lot of guardrails in. We put in the guardrails we could for what we know about at this moment, and we will continue to keep fighting as it goes on.
Yeah, the only thing I say about AI is that whatever you think it can't do, just put the word yet.
Oh, yeah. And they were saying, well, we're not going to do that. We don't plan to do that. And it's like, okay, yet. And
right.
Also, A, we don't believe you. B, yet. C, it's not just about you. It's about anyone who signs our contract. We need to put these rules in place.
All right. This was great. Thank you so
much
for doing
this. This was great. It was nice to talk to you.
I really feel like this was a great follow-up to the previous interview. And I'm really interested to see where things roll on from here. But I got to wrap up because it's not that long a show. All right.
It was great to be here.
And that's all the time we have for today. Thanks so much for taking this trip down the rabbit hole. For more of our content, including our movie reviews, visit our website, norestfortheweekendpodcast.com. Be sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast app or on YouTube, youtube.com/getbehindtherabbit. I'd like to thank my guest, Linda Powell, and our sponsor, JMR Rentals, for Behind the Rabbit Productions. I'm Jason Godby. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.
This is the BTRP Media Network.